I mean, this is just a brutal, brutal virus. I think that the dreams that you have on COVID are extremely visceral, and most of us have had to go through this alone, which is just a kind of an underspoken part of this whole experience. You know, you have to isolate from your loved ones. You can't get the help you need, especially this kind of first group of pioneers who we didn't know when we weren't infectious anymore. We literally just were not able to get the help that we need and still kind of aren't.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Culturally Relevant, a podcast about film, television, art, and culture. I'm David Chen, and today is Thursday, July 9th, 2020. I hope everyone is doing okay out there, staying safe, and staying healthy. There's a bunch of stuff I want to talk about today before we get to our main interview, which is with Hannah Davis. But let me talk first about a couple follow-ups from previous episodes. A couple episodes ago, I spoke with my wife about what it was like to visit the Capitol Hill Occupied Protest, or the CHOP, previously known as the CHAZ, or the Autonomous Zone in Seattle. And overall, when we went there, we found an area that was vibrant and thriving with ideas. Of course, in the time since then, a lot has changed. The CHOP has basically been dismantled. And there are a number of accounts online that I would encourage you to read if you want to learn more about the last days of the CHOP and what happened there. There's an article in Slate I direct you to, also in The Intercept. I think the way it was dismantled was pretty brutal from what I can tell. There was an announcement one morning, and then hundreds of police just went through there clearing everything out. By the end, of course, it was largely a homeless population that was there, and so many of the people that were there were arrested. So it's a pretty rough ending to this thing that had sprung up virtually overnight and had captured the attention of the country. When I read these pieces about the CHOP's legacy, the three demands that were put forth, I'm quoting here from a citizen journalist at Slate, the three demands that were put forth were to defund the Seattle Police Department by at least 50%, invest that money in the community, and release protesters without charges. And so those three demands are the idea of CHOP, end quote. Those are ultimately the legacy that CHOP leaves, is like those ideas, those concepts, and I think people are continuing the work even after the CHOP has been dismantled. But I did want to give an update on what happened there. But let's turn our attention to the other crisis, other than police brutality, that this country is dealing with, and that is coronavirus. On July 8th, there were 59,000 new cases of coronavirus, 948 new deaths, according to the New York Times. And, you know, I want to start by acknowledging that it is truly horrifying times that we're living in right now. I think that we have a federal leadership that is completely asleep at the wheel, that is reactive and not proactive. And thousands of lives are being lost unnecessarily. People are fighting over masks as part of a culture war in ways that were completely stoked by the government. And there is no end in sight. And not only is there no end in sight, but I think we are just at the beginning of how bad this is going to be. I think we are going to see exponential growth to, you know, 100,000 cases a day pretty soon, according to Dr. Fauci. And there seems to be very little we can do to stop it, because nobody is going to turn over control to the adults in the room. Our institutions have completely failed us. And we will be experiencing the results of this for a generation. There's an interview that Wired did with Larry Brilliant, who is one of the people who helped to eradicate smallpox. They did an interview with him 100 days ago, and now they're doing one with him again. And I would strongly recommend you read this. I think it's a really great summary of where we are, how far we've come, how badly the U.S. is positioned right now. But one thing that is clear in this article is that we have learned a little bit more about how COVID-19 impacts people. I'm going to quote here from the article. 3 months ago, we had only a couple hundred cases of this novel virus. We now have over 11 million cases and 500,000 deaths globally. The virus has been speeding along at an exponential speed, but so has science. So now we can begin to understand that this virus attacks the circulatory system. It attacks the vascular and nervous systems. It attacks the respiratory system. It attacks our ability to bring in oxygen. That's why people can go to the hospital and be on their phone, not in any respiratory distress, but have oxygen saturation in the 50s, which in the old days we think of as near death. It also makes you understand why you can get these COVID toes, why you can lose your sense of taste or smell, why you can have a stroke. The virus attacks blood vessels. It creates blood clots. That's probably one of the reasons why it causes strokes. We have a very large number of deaths due to kidney failure, and we're having terrible results from the ventilators that we were so obsessed about early on, though it's looking a little bit better because we've learned more about how to use them for this disease. We've learned a tremendous amount about this virus, about how it infects people, about how it kills. But the big surprise to me is the kind of pan-organ nature of the attack. It gives a lie to anybody who thought that a comparison with influenza was in the ballpark, end quote. And he ends by saying that I was hopeful that what will happen is what happened after the Second World War. We had peered over the brink of the abyss and decided each of us would give up a little bit of our sovereignty in order to create the United Nations. That is happening today, but it's happening without the United States of America, end quote. It's a tragedy. It's something that I think about every day, that I'm depressed about every single day. But as much as we've learned, I also think there's a lot we still don't know about the virus. I still think we are in the early phases of understanding this thing and how to treat it. And one piece of evidence that that's where we are is this article that Ed Yong wrote for The Atlantic, which I would also recommend reading. The headline of this article is COVID-19 can last for several months. The disease's long haulers have endured relentless waves of debilitating symptoms and disbelief from doctors and friends. And in this article, Ed Yong goes to talk about people who have had COVID-19, been experiencing the symptoms or the aftermath for months. These people are often referred to as long haulers. And today I'm going to speak with a long hauler. Hannah Davis is an artist and independent researcher living in New York City. She's one of the researchers behind Patient ResearchCOVID19.com, which is an analysis of prolonged COVID-19 symptoms conducted by a patient-led research team. Now, I first learned about Hannah from both this article in The Atlantic, and also there was a viral, there've been a few viral threads on Twitter from people who have gotten COVID and had it for months and been dealing with the symptoms for months. And it's a side of the story that I don't think the media is really talking about. You know, I think for the first couple months, the way I understood it was, hey, if you're young, you don't have that much to worry about, and you have like a huge percentage chance of surviving. And now we have learned that it does really impact younger people, potentially in lifelong, life-altering ways. So I speak with Hannah about her experience with COVID-19 and how she's approached the aftermath, and the side of the story that she wants to tell of what it's been like to live with COVID-19 for over 100 days. And again, want to caveat that we're still all learning about the virus and its impacts and how to properly diagnose it and how to properly care for people who have it. And so I think just in general, for any of the articles that I recommend, for any of these interviews that I conduct with people who talk about this, just know that we're still in early stages, and to apply the skepticism that you would to any piece of media that you read these days. But all that said, I am extremely grateful to Hannah for her time today, and I think that her story is one that should be heard, and that you should look into patientresearchcovid19.com and let that be a piece of the puzzle that shapes your perception of this pandemic that we're all dealing with right now. If you appreciate the work that this podcast is doing, there's a few things you can do to help me out that would take a few seconds of your time. It would mean a huge deal to me. Number one, leave a review for this podcast on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you're listening to. It really does help me to stand out. Number two, follow this podcast on Twitter, CrevShow, C-R-E-V-S-H-O-W. And of course, you can also share this podcast on your social media. Share this conversation if it gave you something to think about. I'd really appreciate that. You can find more episodes of this podcast at culturallyrelevantshow.com. Email me at culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com. Stay tuned for my weekly recommendations. Here is my conversation with Hannah Davis. Hannah Davis, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me about the day that you first believe you contracted COVID-19.
So I'm not sure the day I contracted it still, but I had been in isolation for 11 days, only going to the grocery store. So my assumption has been that I got it at one of two trips to the grocery store. So the first symptom I had actually was really bizarre. I couldn't read or parse a text message from my friend. We were just kind of scheduling a video chat, and I realized I just couldn't read their message. And I kind of thought I was tired and maybe a little distracted and hazy, so I didn't think too much about it. But then an hour later, I had a slightly elevated temperature, just of 99 degrees. And that was kind of the first time I thought, oh, I might be sick. And I immediately thought COVID because I was in one of the biggest hotspots at the time in Brooklyn. And it turned out to be true. And this was March 25th.
Did you get tested or did you just match your symptoms to what people have said COVID consists of?
Well, so at the time, testing wasn't available. I think that it's actually been kind of surprising how just doctors forget about this. I mean, testing wasn't available in Brooklyn outside of hospitalization for almost a month. So I did actually get tested 30 days out on what I call day 30. And this is a huge problem, actually, because the PCR tests are already very inaccurate. The lowest false negative rate is 20% at day 3 of symptoms. And from there, it just kind of declines. So after day 21, the false negative rate is actually 66%. And so being tested on day 30, the doctor told me, oh, you're going to get a negative test. And I did.
So when you first believe you contracted COVID-19, like what was your knowledge of the disease at the time? Like what were your beliefs around it at that time?
I mean, I definitely believed it was real. I already felt very imbued in it. You could hear the ambulances already, even in late March. I was under the assumption that it was going to be very mild. That's what they were telling us, especially for people who are younger. I'm 32. I thought it would be probably 2 weeks and then I'd be fine. I even put a note on my calendar to donate plasma and, you know, kind of had that in my sight. But I wasn't prepared at all for, you know, being sick 106 days later.
You talked about not being able to parse a text and that kind of being the onset of it. What other symptoms did you experience as time went on?
Oh, boy. So for me, I've had a lot of neurological symptoms. My biggest one has actually been memory loss, which has been surprising. I have almost no working memory. I can't generally remember what I did 10 seconds ago. At night, I don't generally remember what I did in the morning. I don't remember what I did yesterday. I've had, you know, attention, brain fog issues. I had a kind of nonstop low-grade fever for all but basically 18 days of the 106 days. Pain in all of my joints, extreme fatigue. I've had really bad tachycardias on minimal activity, like a heart rate of 150 or 160, just climbing one flight of stairs. I've had three sets of extremely severe headaches, once in April, once in May, and then once in June. I've had blurry vision. As I said, I've had the kind of difficulty reading and making meaning from text, difficulty understanding other people, difficulty talking and word finding, had sensitivity to light and noise. Constant insomnia, which I'm extremely grateful stopped about a week ago. So I'm hoping that is a sign of improvement to come. But a kind of really weird insomnia that's just not anxiety at all. It's, you know, I wasn't laying there having racing thoughts. It was just like my body kind of had me suspended. I've had tinnitus, difficulty temperature regulating, extreme back pain, phantom smells. I had loss of feeling in both my arms. This kind of internal tremor, like there's a truck outside, but there's no truck. Just my body is shaking. Had bruising, petechiae on my feet, which is a specific type of rash that shows up with COVID, which can indicate clotting issues. Just what felt like kidney and kind of internal organ pain, pain under my ribs, chest pain. And this is in addition to, you know, the cough and shortness of breath.
One of the reasons I reached out to you and am interested in kind of looking more into people who've had COVID for a long time is, like, it strikes me that there are two sort of levels of people's beliefs about this that you're trying to break through, right? Like, level one is you have not tested positive for COVID for reasons that you've explained, which is that tests done after a certain point often come back negative, even if they are not. And then the second sort of state of beliefs is that people seem to think, like, oh, it just lasts for a couple weeks and then it goes away. So those are kind of two separate things that you're trying to fight against. And I'm curious, like, what makes you convinced that the thing you have is COVID versus something else that might have similar symptoms?
Well, for me personally, there's nothing like this. It feels so different than the flu, than a cold. It really kind of is like is unlike anything I've ever physically experienced before. It's a really, really bizarre virus, and many people say that kind of same thing. It just, you don't have the linear progression. The relapses are a strong indicator of COVID, and you know that type of back and forth is kind of a well-known symptom at this point. But more importantly, I mean, the people who have had negative tests, unless their doctors are really well-informed, there's a lot of people who are totally denied access to treatment based on their negative test. And this is a problem because of the false negative rate I mentioned earlier. But one of the things we really tried to study was that we tried to compare the positive and negative groups. And when we did the research, we accepted anyone with symptoms who thought they had COVID. And then we just divided them into groups and compared the symptoms. And 60 symptoms were exactly the same in both groups. And the big difference between the groups was actually how early people got tested. So people with positive tests got tested on day 10 on average, where people with negative tests got tested on day 16 on average. And that is kind of in line with what I had said earlier about the false negative rate going up as time goes on. But the really important thing I want to stress here is that clinical diagnoses are valid and should be considered more valid than tests, especially with these false negative rates. I received 4 clinical diagnoses, so I generally didn't feel like I had to worry too much because enough doctors were like, you definitely have COVID, that I didn't think too much. I haven't considered the test too much of an issue until more recently, when we're starting to see post-COVID clinics pop up at like Mount Sinai and other places, and they're requiring positive tests. So one of the things I'm really hoping to emphasize is that clinical diagnoses really have to be accepted as valid indicators of having had COVID.
And a clinical diagnosis just being, rather than some kind of chemical test, like a diagnosis from a doctor talking with a patient about their symptoms? Or
exactly. Like, yeah, a clinical diagnosis just means that a doctor listens to your symptoms, talks to you, and says you have it.
You talked about how you were expecting this all to be over in a couple weeks, which I think is a reasonable belief that a lot of people have, right? Like, a lot of people think, hey, a couple weeks later, I'm going to know one way or the other whether I'm in the, you know, 1 to 3% that is going to die from this, and then maybe I can move on with my life. When did it first start to dawn on you that that would not be your prognosis?
Oh, geez. The first day I had a relapse, a friend sent me an Instagram post of a celebrity who was having relapses. And it was just very lucky timing because that morning I had felt bad again and was just not. It was just a confusing feeling, you know. It's just really hard to explain how weird it is when you're so used to getting linearly better that you all of a sudden are not. And that was when I was made aware that relapses were really common to coronavirus. And since day 13, I've just had ups and downs the whole entire time. And this was, you know, another thing we found is that most people have relapses, and even weirder, most people have relapses that include new symptoms. So for me, that's definitely the case. Like all the symptoms I listed earlier did not happen at the same time. It kind of felt like it went through my body and, you know, was affecting different parts of my body. Super, super weird.
In an interview you gave to The Atlantic, you said, quote, I've been very concerned by friends and family who just aren't taking this seriously because they think you're either asymptomatic or dead. This middle ground has been hellish, end quote. Can you tell me more about what you meant by that statement?
You know, it goes back to the narrative of things being mild and the fact that because people are young, they're not going to be affected by this. And you know, there's so much that goes into it, but, you know, part of it is what kind of empathy you have toward other people and understanding that you can be a vector even if you feel fine. But also, you know, the early studies that are coming out on the long haulers are saying the rate of long haulers is 10-15%. You know, that's a lot higher than the 1-3% of people who are dying.
And you're saying like 10-15% of people who have COVID become long haulers from what you've seen?
From what I've seen, well, from early studies I've seen, I don't think anything is definite. And I think that number is significantly higher because we're not being tested, because we're not being counted. You know, a lot of the numbers are for people that were hospitalized, and only 4.4% of the long haulers in our study were hospitalized. So these numbers are much higher than anyone is thinking.
When you said this middle ground has been hellish, like what did you mean by that exactly?
I mean, this is just a brutal, brutal virus. I think that you know, with the insomnia, you know, you're sleep deprived. The dreams that you have on COVID are extremely visceral and almost nightmarish. Most of us have had to go through this alone, which is just a kind of an underspoken part of this whole experience. You know, you have to isolate from your loved ones. You can't get the help you need, especially this kind of first group of pioneers who we didn't know when we weren't infectious anymore. We literally just were not able to get the help that we need and still kind of aren't. And I consider myself a pretty even keeled person. I'm not generally a complainer. I feel very resilient. But it just is so demanding on you physically and emotionally. And I really do think that that narrative is just kind of not out in the public yet, how incredibly difficult this is. You know, the body politic support group where we were born out of has been just such a lifesaver. And you'll hear that over and over again. Like, these support groups are genuine lifesavers because you know, if you're up in the middle of the night and you feel like you might be having a stroke or a heart attack, or you just feel like you might die, like that's just a genuine concern many nights. You know, you can pop in the support group and get instant help, and that's really the only place that is accessible to us right now.
Mm. The group you're referring to, Body Politic, is a support group for people who have COVID, basically, right?
Yes, it's a really amazing support group.
It's been interesting to see the narrative that you describe in the media, right? I mean, I think that the things that you're describing are starting to come out. Like, I have heard of people who, like young people who get it, who are like devastated by the disease. You know, they get it, they're young and they have a stroke, or they have a series of strokes, and or their lungs are never the same. Like, I've seen that kind of at the edges of the narrative, but it hasn't really been part of the main narrative. And certainly people who have been dealing with this over a few months has not been really a part of the narrative. That being said, to be fair, I did read about you in this piece for The Atlantic, right? So it is starting to creep out there. But what has it been like for you, kind of having dealt with it and then seeing how people are talking about it? Like, what are your biggest points of frustration with the narrative out there?
I mean, at first it definitely was that it wasn't out there at all. The research group was a lifesaver for me, just to have kind of this focus and intention. And we have been, you know, expressly working with the press to get the stories out there. And when we first released this report, I mean, we released this report in early May. It's almost 2 months later, the media is kind of just catching up. But when we first released it, we have this big data point in here that basically, you know, positive versus negative groups are almost identical. And people are sick for over 8 weeks. And it was kind of very clear when we were talking to journalists, like who believed us and who didn't. And, we had some stories fall through because we had examined negative people even. And I think everything changed with just having Ed believe us. And I think that
Ed, the author of the Atlantic piece, yeah.
Yes, exactly. I mean, yeah. I think that he really got it into the public. A week after that piece came out, I went to a doctor's appointment, and she mentioned long haulers, and it was just extremely validating just to kind of have that happen. But I think the things that are being missed are the false negative rates, for sure. People need to be getting help no matter what their testing status is. This particularly seems to be happening outside of major cities, you know, where doctors maybe haven't seen dozens of COVID patients, and they're just reading the WHO guidelines or something. But also, you know, the fact that we're a patient-centered research group really kind of gets information out there so much earlier. You know, we knew 2 or 3 months ago that neurological side effects were happening, serious neurological side effects. Our report included things like hearing loss, vision loss, facial paralysis, tremors, tingling in the extremities, and nerve damage. But that's also the kind of thing that is only coming out months later. And I think that all of this really just comes down to an issue of not believing patients and not believing people have a competent understanding of what they've been experiencing and of their bodies. And I personally feel like I've been fairly lucky in that I had doctors early on in New York City who believed me, but so many long haulers don't have that. And it makes everything worse. It prevents them from getting treatment. It prevents them from getting the tests they need. You know, we have people that are, in their 20s and 30s who are having, you know, probable mini strokes and heart attacks, like I mentioned, and just being just being told that it's anxiety or depression or PTSD or, in my case, even I got a neurologist visit fairly early on with the help of my doctor. And that was really difficult in New York at the time. Everything was overloaded. And the first neurologist said, "Oh, you have brain fog. Oh, that's just ADHD. But this was like, I had forgotten my partner's name. I had started a fire in my apartment. There were severe symptoms. And if there's kind of one thing I could get out there, it's to doctors and, close loved ones. You have to believe the people in your life. Like, we're not being dramatic at all. And many of us, like, seem to be less dramatic people than average, which is also kind of surprising.
Doctors not listening to patients is a huge issue, even to begin with pre-COVID. And now we're dealing with, if this was a book, the story of COVID was a book, we'd be like in the prelude or the chapter one, basically, right? So I think there's still just a lot to learn for everyone. But when did you move from, hey, I have COVID, I'm a long hauler, to I want to get involved with patient research?
It was pretty instant. I found the support group, I believe, fairly quickly after it was formed in April. And Gina had already started forming the research group, and they had already released the first survey and had just gotten the survey back. And I've worked a lot with data, so I volunteered to help on that.
So just to be clear, the support group is Body Politic, which is a support group for COVID long haulers. And Gina Asaf is the person who's heading up the research, which you said sprang from that support group, right?
Yes, exactly. For me, it was a clear indicator of a way I could help, especially, that's kind of my go-to coping strategy, is just kind of getting information out there and helping as I'm able. And it was really inspiring just to see kind of how quickly everyone was working and how, patient-centered research is amazing and kind of has a long historical narrative. It was, for me, the first kind of exposure to this, and it makes so much more sense. Like, we can ask the right questions because we have experienced the symptoms. And, we know that, if someone comes to us and says, "Oh, I've been having tinnitus and a hand tremor, and, my heart is just beating so much faster than it ever has," like, to us, that will be very quickly indicative of having COVID. And we learn things because we're basically, crowdsourcing every day with 6,000 people who are in the same boat. And that's just not something that even researchers and doctors have access to. So I really am hopeful that, the patient-centered research is going to be taken more seriously and listened to going forward. And we're working on a second survey now around neurological symptoms, mental health, as well as antibody testing. We're seeing a lot of negatives, which is curious. And we're looking at symptoms through 16 weeks, where the first survey we had only looked at symptoms through 8 weeks. But it turns out that people are sick for a lot longer.
If people want to help with your efforts, how should they do that?
So they can go to our website, and if they want to take the survey, they can sign up for the mailing list, and we'll send it out when it's available. And we're also looking to fundraise. All of us are volunteers. Some of us are out of work, and we have some costs associated with the surveys. So if people would like to donate, we would really appreciate that.
Let me ask you this last question, very, very basic question. Maybe we should have started with this, is like, how are you doing right now? You've had this for over 100 days at this point, and you're kind of spearheading this research, but you've also said it's been a very lonely experience and a challenging one, given everything going on right now. How are you doing? What gets you through the day? What's happening in just your regular life right now?
No question, the research group and the support group are getting me through my days. They are by far the most valuable support network I have, and the most valuable work I'm doing. And I am just so, so grateful because I don't know how I would have gone through this without them, to be honest. I have temporarily moved home with my family and my partner. So I'm less isolated than I was in the first 2 months. And that has been nice. But I'm still sick. I'm still, you know, dealing with what my neurologist thinks is, you know, kind of some brain injury due to COVID. Even just fighting the virus this long, he says, can cause a brain injury. And I've just started doing rehab. So I think things are slightly looking up for me, but I still feel very much in the middle of it. I don't feel like I'm through the woods. I don't feel like it's over. And I'm just, you know, I'm grateful for people like you and the other journalists who have kind of helped us get the story more public.
Well, Hannah Davis is an independent researcher living in New York City. She's also one of the researchers behind patientresearchcovid19.com, which is an analysis of prolonged COVID-19 symptoms conducted by a patient-led research team. Hannah, I really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for talking to me, and I wish you the best of luck in the days ahead.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's talk about weekly recommendations. It's the part of the week where I talk about what I've been reading, listening to, watching, and recommend something to you. And this week I want to recommend my YouTube videos to you. I've been posting a bunch of YouTube videos lately, but there's a few I want to highlight. Number one, Hamilton, the musical, just hit Disney Plus. I posted an in-depth review of Hamilton on my YouTube channel. I recommend you check that out. I also posted a short film called Gather in the Corner, which imagines what it would be like if teachers were armed in American schools. And so I'd recommend you check that out. It's on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/Dave Chensky. And also, I did a vlog. I made a vlog where I go to a drive-in movie theater and kind of recount what that experience is like. And it's super meaningful in this day and age. I haven't been to a theater of any kind for months, and it was just so awesome to be able to go to one recently. So I vlog my experience. You can watch that at my YouTube channel at youtube.com/Dave Chensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y. And of course, I also link to everything that I mention in the show notes. Thanks so much for listening to this week's episode of Culturally Relevant. And you can find more episodes at culturallyrelevantshow.com. Email us at culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com. Follow this podcast on Twitter at CrevShow, C-R-E-V-S-H-O-W. This podcast was edited and produced by me, David Chen, and it was powered by Simplecast, which is a great service if you're looking to launch or maintain a new podcast. They have great analytics, great podcast management. Check them out at simplecast.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on Culturally Relevant.